Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for your prompt attention and your return. This is a very important part of the day where we work together to describe our opinions about the suggestions and solutions that have been proposed so far. Carolyn Chicoine is going to moderate this part of the session. There's a few different ways to participate. I encourage you to step up to the microphone and ask questions. We're going to take questions on all the topics, all the proposed solutions in the recommendations at one time, and Carolyn's going to review that and also the rules for engagement. So I thank you in advance for your participation, and I think I'm just going to turn it over to Carolyn now.
Is there someone back there that can, if they put up the IRT's presentation, slide two? Oh, you got it. Okay. So just so that you all can follow along, point three has the different recommendations, at least with the terms that the IRT dubbed them. In the IP clearinghouse, there's the globally protected marks list, IP claims, and actually we just noticed that Sunrise isn't in there. So anybody who has questions or comments on Sunrise can raise those. The URS, post-delegation dispute, FICU is an expansion of the test for string comparison during initial evaluation. If you have feedback forms or question cards that you haven't submitted yet, Carla and Haley from ICANN are in the front row here, and you can either bring them down to them or occasionally they'll be walking around if you want to hand them to them. And again, especially if you want things to be maybe read in anonymously. For now, since we have no idea what the feedback, the volume of the feedback will be, let's try to keep it to everybody going up, at least, you know, taking one turn at the mic, and let's see how it evolves. And then if we see that we have more time, if people, one question at the mic at a time, so that we, again, at least make sure that everybody has a chance to speak at least once, and then we'll open it up further if time permits. We're taking the break at 2:30. Again, when you go to the mic, if you wouldn't mind, I know some of you, but to state your name and your organization or affiliation, that'd be great. So we'll start with Kathy.
This did say good morning, but now it's good afternoon. My name is Catherine Kleiman, and I represent a group not even listed on the descriptions of attendees on the ICANN sign-up for today. I represent registrants. Actually, I'm going to talk to you guys. Sorry, I've talked to the IRT many times in Sydney. I'm going to talk to you. I represent registrants. We are the enormous base of the ICANN pyramid. In my group, ICANN's non-commercial users constituency, our members register their domain names on behalf of human rights groups, public interest groups, community and political groups worldwide. Some of our members risk their lives and their livelihood to post content about corruption, extortion, and malfeasance. We believe it is some of the very highest uses of the internet. Yet our domain names and those we register in the future will be at risk under the IRT proposals. And in the interest of time, I will share three short points. First, the IRT proposal provides for only one type of abuse when there are two. The IRT fears trademark infringement, but not trademark lawyer abuse. Every day, trademark lawyers threaten domain names. Under the guise of trademark infringement, they drive out new competitors, squash those who investigate and criticize them, or simply try to snatch away a good domain name they did not think to register. The next group that meets to discuss the IRT proposals, we request dig much deeper into the experience of abuse on both sides of the aisle. The next version must mitigate both sets of abusive experience. Second, the non-commercial users constituency believes the IRT proposal goes far beyond the two limits which should be its bounds, that ICANN is a technical body with a limited scope and mission, and that trademark law, as it exists under every law, is bounded by protections for fair use and free speech, freedom of expression internationally, and simply the right to use language. For example, the IP Clearinghouse takes ICANN into the job of a global rights of a global intellectual property rights protection and manager far beyond its mission as a technical manager of the domain name system. For ICANN to enter this field would require become almost like a trademark office, an examiner of the validity of registered and unregistered rights being entered. For ICANN not to be such an examiner would create a gigantic database of unverified intellectual property, which will be misused not only against future domain name registrants, but I truly believe far outside the scope of ICANN. And I've talked with many of you about the unintended consequences of this database under the ICANN mantle. Certainly, there's a need for this type of service, but the market has shown it can and will meet it and provide it. The market should be allowed to operate in this case. The globally protected marks list brings ICANN into an area where even WIPO dares not tread. There is no international consensus on globally famous marks. There's no such list prepared by the World Intellectual Property Organization nor any international organization. It is beyond the scope and mission of ICANN to be the first down this path. Further, the GPML proposal goes awry by protecting these trademarks not as marks for certain goods and services, but as strings of characters protected against across all new top-level domains, regardless of use or relevance. This list will remove from the domain name dictionary basic words such as apple, sun, time, and people. This ICANN should not allow. The Uniform Rapid Suspension Service is among our greatest concerns. We believe it will replace the uniform dispute resolution policy with a faster, cheaper, and fundamentally more unfair process. It strips the UDRP of those few aspects that actually made it fair, including strong requirements for notice and a reasonable response time. We believe domain name registrants will lose their domain names and website speech before they even know a challenge has been filed. As many said in their comments, in Sydney, this is a case, what we really need to do is go into a process of UDRP reform, not UDRP replacement. Further, we have strong objections to the thick who is and the post-delegation dispute mechanism as drafted, but I know my time grows short. Overall, the IRT report as drafted includes one half of trademark law, its rights, but not its limits or fair use protections. The free and fair use of language requires the balance, and the free and fair use of domain names requires the balance as well. For registrants, that enormous group at the base of the ICANN pyramid, those registering domain names for years in the future, we truly must get these rules right, and we truly have to make them fair, and I look forward to participating with you in that process. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. It seemed that it was more of a comment, but I'll leave it if anyone on the panel wants to address any of the specific concerns. No? Just go ahead and go to the mic and give us your name, please, and your affiliation.
My name is Jay Salzberger. I'm here on my own, although for some time I've been an advocate of free software and freedom of the Internet. I was alerted last week that this meeting was going to be held. Now, I tend to follow websites, mailing lists, where there's discussion of these sorts of things. Now, I'm not on any of the ICANN mailing lists. But, you know, I saw no notice at /dot or any of the other standard places. And I know that the people at /dot are noisy. I'd like to make several requests. You publicize these things much more. That's the first one. The second one is, I'd like to suggest that the present committee who put together, what's the name of it? I'm just forgetting. The IRT. Recuse yourselves as being a body which is entirely slanted toward particular interests of very large corporations. It's not your business to create a trans-treaty extra supranational court dealing with trademarks. It's absolutely not your business. And we have all sorts of contradictory things. We have, for example, the claim that, well, this and that is just a database. Well, if it's just a database, it's not going to cost much money. What's going to cost money is resolution of disputes. You're claiming that, in effect, you should take the place of national courts. And you should take the place, indeed, of bodies that deal with international treaties dealing with trademarks. This is not okay. Now, as for specific offenses within the thing, even accepting the legitimacy, which I do not, of the recommendations, you actually propose to create two classes of trademark holders? Well, I guess nowadays it's okay. The rich get treated differently from those who are not rich. Well, it's not okay with this American. Thank you.
Thanks. And I'll just say...
One more thing. Invite Kathy Kleiman at your expense to sit on the dais 2 days from now. Do it. You know something? You'll be able to fend off further attacks like mine. You say, look, we put Kathy Kleiman on.
Thank you.
But right now, you don't put her on, we'll know.
Thank you very much.
I actually, could I
address the first point, just in terms of the publication of the meeting, just so that was not IRT's role, that's ICANN's role. So just wanted to be clear that, that was not our job, or do we have authority necessarily to be for publicizing of the meeting. Christina?
We actually don't exist anymore, sir. We failed. We stopped to exist when we completed our report.
Let us up there. Don't say such a thing. You were invited.
No.
Yeah. Excuse me. We understand that everyone's very passionate about their feelings, but I would ask, excuse me, sir. We gave you the mic, and Christina, did you want to add, Christina, anything?
No, I would be,
can I ask who's next in line on the right here?
Thank you.
Let's move on.
What's that? Well, I'm trying to go back and forth.
Ask ICANN.
Sir.
Thank you. My name is Danny Younger. I generally tend to speak on behalf of registrants today. These are simply my own comments. There's one matter that's troubling me a great deal. I recall several years ago that ICANN took a particular position, and I am now seeing the opposite of that position coming forward through this particular agenda. Let me get to the point, and I will ask Jeff Newman to weigh in on this. But I recall a time when we had .biz enter into the namespace, and a challenge was received from the International Bank of Settlements. The bank claimed, rightfully so, that under the Paris Treaty, they were entitled to protections because their acronym, BIS, in one of the European languages, was duly protected. ICANN General Counsel at the time, Louis Tuton, wrote an opinion which made it absolutely clear that at the top level, there are no protections. These are identifiers. I have not seen the position of ICANN that was put forward that many years ago discussed by the folk here today. To me, it seems like a reversal of what was a prior ICANN position, and I think it would help us all if we could have some discussion about this. Thank you.
Jeff, if you want to take that, but I want to remind people that we are up here to discuss our final report and not the legitimacy of this group that ICANN impaneled. Again, you're more than welcome to come and make your comment heard, but we as a team will not be addressing those. Jeff?
Yes. So, Danny, that was correct. The Bank of International Settlements filed a challenge. And in that circumstance, what they said is by virtue of the letters BIS, that they just had a ultimate right in biz and that it should be taken out. The difference, what we're saying here, and if you look at the letter from the General Counsel, they said in and of itself, the three letters, the string, has no meaning. And you can't trademark a string. And that's the same principle that's being adopted, that was adopted at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, which says a TLD string cannot in and of itself be a trademark. That's not saying that a trademark, that a three-letter designation can't infringe on someone's trademark. So in other words, if we had gotten, say we weren't biz, but we were BIS, and we got into the international settlement business, that's not saying or not prohibiting the Bank of International Settlements from having any cause of action against us if that's what we were to do with the string. So, I mean, I think you're you're remembering a right example, but it did say the letter. It basically says in and of itself that's not a problem. But in the manner in which it's used, it could be. And that's what we're saying here. And I've heard it a couple times, too. I heard Kathy say it publicly now. She basically said that the GPML is to take out a whole bunch of generic words out of circulation that, so that no one other than the trademark owner can use it. At least that's the perception I heard from Kathy. That's not the reality here. What we're saying is that basically if there is a match to a GPML at the top level, then it's initially blocked, but there's a reconsideration process that we put into the IRT report so that if there was someone that wanted a .time that had nothing to do with Time Magazine or whatever else Time's registered for. I apologize, Fab. I'm sure it's more than that.
You can ask
and I'm sure there's people out here, so forgive me for there may be other things. But if there was an example, a non-infringing use, that they absolutely could, through the reconsideration process, get use of it. So, I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric around, but that's not reality of what's in the report. And I'll save
thanks for
the rest.
Clarification, Jeff. It's appreciated.
Okay. We'll go to the other side of the room.
Thank you. This is Eric Brenner Williams from CORE. And both to Danny and to Jeff, I just remind you that that Louis' letter actually cited IO Design v. CORE. So that's just a blast from the past.
That's right.
Yes, I have two questions. The first one.
Could you give us your name? Sorry.
Ian. Oh, I'm sorry. That's Lynn Goodendorf. I'm from Intercontinental Hotels Group.
Okay, thank you.
My first question is for Brian from WIPO. In your presentation, you had some statistics about cyber squatting. I could not see if that included organizations such as UNICEF and the American Red Cross, but I have read reports and wondered if you can confirm that these organizations have been exploited by cyber squatting and by fraudulent domain registrations. That's my first question.
Just briefly on that, I believe the chart you're referring to was the pie chart, which was cyber squatting by activity. And nonprofits are a sector that are targeted. I'm trying to find the exact numbers here. I believe that would just fall under other in the pie chart that was here. But in fact, on the center's website, there's a search function in the database of cases which you could search for a specific nonprofit entity to see if there were a case lodged by them in the past. But I don't know specific examples of those two organizations off the top of my head.
Thank you. I mean, my point is that cyber squatting is not limited to just big corporations and that there are other organizations that are impacted
in
an adverse way, and it also impacts consumers when that type of activity takes place.
So I don't have a stat for it, but I can tell you prior to working for Time Warner and kind of the big brand companies that the people are, you know, saying we represent, I was in private practice and I did represent people like the Firefighters Association. Who, after 9/11, we had to shut down a myriad of domain names that were all used to get people to send in money on behalf of helping firefighters who had been hurt during 9/11, and which, in fact, were actually just fraud sites defrauding people of their money, which they thought they were giving to a good cause, all under the name of a nonprofit. So it does happen, and it happens every day.
Okay, thank you. My second question, I don't know which individual to address it to, but it relates to the timing. At one time, the target date for receiving applications for the new GTLDs was the end of this year. I understand perhaps that has been postponed, but you know, we have submitted formal comments, and we believe that processes that the IRT has recommended need to be in place before we start opening up just some unlimited number of top-level domains. So my question is about the timing.
Kurt, you want to grab that?
Hi, thank you. So it's certainly intended to move the process forward as quickly as possible, but not without the right amount of deliberation and consultation. And so what you're seeing here in this open forum today is that ICANN and the big ICANN is taking steps to ensure that the right amount of thought and amendments are made to the applicant guidebook and the process for implementing TLDs before it's implemented. So it's fully intended that this process, be brought to a conclusion, as most of us would define conclusion in this room before we go forward.
Thank
Does that
you.
Answer your question?
Yes, and then just one final comment.
Okay, we need to wrap up so we can, now we're getting a line.
This is very quick. Our marketing team asked me to bring a comment to this meeting that for our 7 brands, we have over 4,000 defensive registrations, second-level registrations, and that as new GLTs are opened up, anyone who thinks they're going to exploit our company and force us to buy thousands more, we're not going to play.
Thank you. All right. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. My name is Dan Neuger. I'm with Hearst Communications, Inc. Now, I noticed some comments in the transcript of the June 24th Sydney meeting where statements were being made like, oh, there aren't that many people that could cough up $185,000 to buy a GTLD. And, I don't know if any of you folks here have had dealings with people like Rick Schwartz, who just pocketed $3 million for Candy.com, or Ari Goldberger, or Frank Schilling, or people like that. And these people are about nothing but money. Don't kid yourself for 1 minute that they won't grab anything that they think they can get their hands on. And even if they think they can't use it, it's going to be held hostage. Now, I'm going to suggest something out here I don't think has been talked about before. You ought to consider putting in some kind of mechanism for protection of company names as well. Now, I know that .ICANN is locked down and no one's going to be able to grab that, but if someone happens to grab something like .Hearst, .Time Warner, .News America, one of these domainers grabs that, I think it's going to get real difficult and real problematic very quickly. So I think that's something that needs to be looked at, because there's a real problem here with the discussions that are being held, I think, because I don't know how many of you folks have ever actually had any dealings with any of these domain names. So I'll just tell you one thing real quick. We're dealing with one guy trying to buy a domain name off, and we offered him a five-figure sum. Nothing that was in use, nothing like that. It was just some park domain. We're trying to deal through a shell company. Message comes back, and another zero, and then we'll talk. So I'm just saying that, before you open Pandora's box, and I think it's good that there's been a lot of discussion about having the clearinghouse and that kind of stuff, before you open Pandora's box, you better make sure that you've got some good protections in place, because otherwise you're going to have some real problems.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Let's go to that side.
Thank you, Caroline. My name is Eric Brunner-Williams. I'm the CTO of CORE. Most of you up there know me. But in a prior work, I spent a lot of time working for Engage, mostly working on cookies and working within the framework of the Internet Advertising Board. My first question, I have several questions, and I'm happy to sit down between questions.
Okay.
But my first question is to Russ and to Fabricio, because both of you mentioned pay-per-click. Fabricio, you mentioned it in the context of porn, and Russ generally. I don't see Google here. I don't see AdSense here. The primary metric for PPC is unique IDs, basically cookies, in order to establish a state in the edge device. And so are we being naive? Are we not addressing the root cause of some of the problems that we're up here dealing with at the string level if we don't address the economic motivation that makes those elements of the string space attractive? I know you haven't addressed this, but you're.
If you're inviting comment on Google's AdSense for Domains program, I'm not going to take the bait today, but that is definitely a consideration for brand owners as they look at issues involving typo-squatted domains where there are pay-per-click sites.
Russ, I wasn't asking a cynical question, and I know you and I don't know each other, so you might not have known that from my asking the question. My interest is, are we missing a root cause by failing to address the economic motivation of rational actors?
it's somewhat unfair because it's kind of a chicken or the egg, which came first. If people didn't register infringing domains, would there be place for remnant traffic come on PPC? If Google wasn't allowing PPC, would people register domains? I don't know. I can tell you that the IRT's mandate by ICANN wasn't to look at Google. I'm sure that if invited to do so outside of the space, many branders would and actually have and are looking at and attacking Google's practices and other search engine practices. So I don't think that you're going to get disagreement from brand owners and trademark attorneys generally that there's more than one problem here. Unfortunately, in this mandate, in the time frame we had, we didn't have the ability to go in and search outside of the domain space. The TLD launch in itself doesn't say, and are there other issues or other companies we should be dealing with? Because obviously that does open Pandora's box and leads to kind of a whole host of work. But I'd invite you to suggest it to ICANN and others and any other forum where we could investigate other problems outside the TLD system.
My interest is simply as our policy issues will come up at London. My interest is simply in the technical issue. If we're not addressing the fundamental mechanism that is driving the system behavior that we are attempting to talk about here.
And if there's something that we missed, definitely point it out and comment. I mean, aside from this.
It's an absolutely
Thank
great
you.
Point. Thank you.
Phil?
Good afternoon. Phil Corwin, Council of the Internet Commerce Association, representing domain investors and developers. I apologize for the fact that I'm really here to make a statement about process and not to ask a question that you have to sit there and listen to it, but that's the only opportunity we're afforded to deliver that message to ICANN staff and hopefully through them to the board. I heard Peter Dengate Thrush say a number of times in Sydney that the job, in his view, the job for the IRT was to develop proposed solutions and to see if they could get consensus support from the community. And I think it's clear to anyone who was at Sydney and heard the public comments there, who has reviewed even a sampling of the comment letters filed by last Monday with ICANN, that big pieces of the IRT report are very contentious, that there is not consensus support within the community. I'm not going to repeat. Our principal concern is a proposed URS. We believe it denigrates due process rights for registrants too much, and that is a major policy change that needs to go through a PDP. But I'm not going to repeat those substantive arguments. One, I said them in Sydney, and they're in our comment letter. And two, I don't think I'm disturbed by the questionnaire distributed today. The comment period closed last Monday, and either the comment period should be reopened for everybody to submit further comments based on what's going on at these meetings, or it shouldn't be open to just people coming to attend these meetings. Either there's a due date or there isn't, but it shouldn't. We shouldn't keep moving the goalposts and changing the rules as the process goes along. Now, some responded to remarks I made in Sydney by saying that our organization was not being constructive or was trying to obstruct the introduction of new GTLDs. Nothing could be further from the truth. All along, we've tried to play a constructive role. We have not personalized any of this debate. We have very strong policy reasons for disagreeing with parts of the report. We've endorsed other parts of your report, the standard sunrise approach and the clearinghouse with some modifications are things we can have no objection to. But we have said, and we would like a constructive, expedited process in the form of an expedited PDP to get everyone with concerns about the present UDRP around the table. There are very good suggestions from our side of the table of how to solve trademark owners' concerns about the current UDRP in regard to the 70% of default cases, how to make that faster and cheaper. And we think that that would result in a better, improved UDRP that would deal with current registrant abuses and complainant abuses. It would put it in place at .com and the other incumbents, which is where you have your major infringement concerns and probably will continue to have them for years to come, no matter what the success of this. And by doing it through ICANN's policy process, ICANN would be, frankly, insulating itself from a lot of potential litigation if they follow their own rules. If they want the community to support the bottom-up policy development process, then they should use it when there are major new policy initiatives. And if they want to be shielded from G12 or the internet takeover, when the U.S. steps aside, they should not turn themselves into a legislative body inventing various new forms of trademark protection for which we don't believe there's sufficient support in existing law. So we're here to say that we're ready and willing to engage constructively and expeditiously in a PDP process which fixes the UDRP for everyone and puts it in place before any new GTLDs open for business. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Seth Johnson. I'm with New Yorkers for Fair Use. And I guess I should start my comments with an expression of regret that I don't think we really have a very clear picture of our policy, what we would say about trademark as such. It's kind of a difficult issue in my mind. But I do have a couple of questions. The first question I think is a little bit personal because I'm addressing it to you as participants on the IRT. Basically, it is, what exactly leads you to think that you can do this? Okay? You have trademark, as I understand, is basically it policed by the trademark holder. And my understanding is that that's because the presumption is for freedom of speech. And our legal regimes, and a number of new legal regimes, are based on that. Now, I know that in other areas of like copyright and trademark, I don't use the term intellectual property because it leads to lazy thinking. We've gone through a process where you actually had a treaty because you knew you were overriding some national process. Like you went to WIPO, you get that first. So my first question is to you, and it is a personal question because I know officially IRT no longer exists. You've already done your job. You've given us some recommendations. What makes you think you can do this? Are you getting some kind of a cue that, yeah, it's okay? And you are only, of course, as has been noted by Kathy Kleeman, you are only representatives of trademark holders. Anybody wish to address that question? That's the first question.
I say that, and I think Kurt addressed it in his initial slides.
Yeah, so the IRT was really... Is this working? Yeah, so the IRT was really requested to be created by the ICANN board in a resolution in the Mexico City meeting where they understood there was considerable discussion about trademark issues and whether and what form of trademark protections, right protection mechanisms, should be part of the new GTLD implementation. And so in order to move that discussion and conversation forward, the board took a two-step approach. The first step was to create the IRT, admittedly, from members of the IP constituency group in order to generate a number of suggested solutions. And then the second step was then to vet those solutions, expose them to public comment, have a public discussion about them so that some solutions could be incorporated into the applicant guidebook. So in order to finish the process development for new TLDs. And the members of the IRT that are here are kind enough to, all their work was done on a volunteer basis, many, many hours of work, and have been kind enough to extend past their tour of duty in order to most competently describe what their ideas are in public rather than to leave us with a document that we would argue about. So we asked them to extend their stay and give us their... lend us their personal expertise.
And I'm going to, I can ask you just to maybe go to the end of the queue, so because we have long queues here. So
I'll go as quickly as I can.
Well, okay. No, I'd like you, if you could, maybe ask one more question, and then we're going to switch.
Just a point of clarification, though, you did also go through a whole process with the GNSL that involved other constituencies, and they reached their own conclusion before this. But my second question is, what are we doing here today? If the IRT has been disbanded, are we simply asking for clarification on your recommendations? And what's going to happen to our input?
Good question.
You may answer that? What? Yeah, so the input that we're asking everybody that's in line here is to say, I support this recommendation of the IRT, or I support a recommendation of the IRT, or By Demand Media, or WIPO, with amendment, or I disagree with this recommendation, and All those comments from Sydney and London and here will be synthesized so that at the end, when there's another version of the guidebook, there'll be a direct tie between the comments that are made and what's published.
And that'll be a new body, not the IRT. And maybe that body would be constituted by other constituencies.
Right. So we're taking input. ICANN is taking input from all constituencies. We'll synthesize that. Take that synthesis, publish it in a version of the guidebook that again is available for public comment to see if we've captured that discussion.
And you are indicating that in fact the only variation that applies here is a modification on the recommendation they presented. Do you agree or disagree or modify?
No, or other solutions are welcome too.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Ron Androff, RNA Partners. And in the interest of full disclosure, we're also considering applying for a new top-level domain. I want to first of all thank the IRT. It was a tremendous amount of work, significantly amount of activity that was generated in a very short period of time. And I think that on the whole, for our part, we're very pleased with the result of the IRT report. And we think you've done a fine job. Particularly identifying also the other areas that ICANN needs to look at vis-a-vis the draft applicant guidebook 1 and 2, where you note that applicants should be permitted to apply for more than one string, for example, dot brand in ASCII, Korean, Kanji, Arabic, and so forth. We very much support that. We believe one operator for one community is very important, and that will also save a lot of problems with regard to having issues that will pop up, particularly with conflict and internet collisions. The other part that I wanted to bring up, and it comes to deals with the issue of string confusion, expansion of the test for string comparison, I think that you've identified a very important aspect, meaning, as well as the other elements that have been discussed. It's important, I think, for ICANN to really define what a top-level domain is. And really, it should be at the apex of a well-defined human activity, community, or sector. Let's avoid bogging down the system with clear objections vis-a-vis string confusion and so forth. As an example, a case in point would be if .nyc were granted its application, and then the Bronx or Brooklyn or Manhattan or others came forward and said, we want to have one too. That would cause a tremendous amount of confusion in the marketplace, not only for the existing TLD being cannibalized by others, but just for consumers at the whole, trying to figure out how do we deal with this. So I think it's really important that the applicant guidebook is clear on this issue. It can be addressed and clarified with regard to confusingly similar strings, and the definition should be expanded beyond the semantic equivalence and should address the cannibalization and diminution of TLDs. It's an urgent matter to be addressed by the interested stakeholders of the TLD, but also has a lot to do with trademark holders, internet security and stability, and the ICANN compliance having to deal with all of that. So what I'm trying to say in very few words is simply we need to have a logical expansion of the namespace, and we should be looking for apex names rather than allowing just any name to come forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Oh, Paul Foody, sold. Quick question of the IP guys. Caroline, because there's so many of you, if you could maybe voice it on behalf of the group, could you please explain what is the fundamental purpose of intellectual property?
I can tell you. Caroline, I think the best thing, trademark law is actually consumer protection law. It actually stems to allow consumers to see what the source of goods and the origin of goods and services are. So that when you go out and buy something, you have some more credibility in what it is you're buying. Whether you choose to buy a substandard product or a very quality product, whatever your opinion of that is, you at least know where it's coming from. So you have some more assurance and consumer confidence in what it is that you're buying. If I go out on the street and want to buy a Porsche off some guy, I hopefully can understand that Porsche comes from an automaker of which I understand provides certain qualities that I like. If everyone were allowed to do Porsche, for example, on every car, you wouldn't know where it comes from, and you wouldn't have any actual confidence. So ultimately, what it's for isn't for brand owners. It's actually for the consumers to which they deliver goods to.
Okay. Now, you've gone off on a tangent there, because the question was, what is the fundamental point of intellectual property law?
That is the fundamental point of trademark.
Well, and I'd like to say, again, we're here to answer questions about the report and the recommendations. And again, if people want to comment on things that they want ICANN to have for the record, they're more than have the prerogative to do so. But
Well, I haven't read the report, and there's every risk that I wouldn't understand the minutiae of it anyway, because I'm not a lawyer. It's a simple question. What is the fundamental point of IP law?
Fabricio, I think, again, we dealt with trademark issues, which, as someone rightly noted, is one aspect of intellectual property. Fabricio has given you an answer. I'm sorry if it doesn't satisfy you.
A second question is what is your definition of the pejorative term cyber squatter?
Cyber squatting is using a domain name.
Do you mean classically speaking, or do you mean to actually add in the terms typo squatting and what others confuse as domain
name?
Cyber squatting generally was a term that started out when people actually registered the mark exclusively. And the first one, I believe, big case was Panavision.com, where somebody registered Panavision. There was a trademark for Panavision, and then would offer to go back and sell. Now, since those days, that term has gone on to apply to different practice, because the initial practice was to register the dead-on mark in a domain name, then call the registrant or the brand owner and ask to sell it. Again, we've obviously morphed beyond that and have many things like typo squatting and things of that nature. But all these things, if you go on any multiple sources on the internet, you can find definitions too.
Okay, but that
okay,
requires...
that's
so,
like
Mr.
To...
Footy, next, let's give some other people a chance. Thanks very
Hello.
Much.
Hello, good afternoon, and thanks a lot. I have nothing so existential to say today. I'm Fred Fellman. I'm from Mark Monitor, and I'm speaking on behalf of Mark Monitor today, who is a domain registrar who represents about 50 of the Fortune 100. And I guess just to begin, it's a statement rather than some questions for you. And to answer Kurt's question, to a large degree, with the exception of a few details, we very much support the work of the IRT, and we actually thank you for your service, especially in light of the conversation here. I think it's difficult to face some of the things that people have said publicly. And I also think to myself, if a large company, you know, defrauded consumers to the extent of billions and billions of dollars the way that we see on the internet, or sold them illicit pharmaceuticals, or did some of the things that, you know, we're talking about happen on the net on a regular basis vis-a-vis domain name system abuse, we'd be crying for regulation and for the government to step in to help those consumers. Instead, I hear a lot of people fighting against that, and that surprises me. In addition to that, I guess when I think of the internet and how difficult it is for the largest brand holders, some of the ones that you guys represent on the panel, it's difficult for them to enforce their rights. It's very expensive. A UDRP action costs several thousand dollars in most cases to have someone professionally prepare it. And to argue that it should be more expensive or more difficult is sort of hard for me to listen to, especially when I consider, you know, the fact that I own domains that actually have been cyber squatted on in the past as well, and I can't actually afford to do it as an individual. So I find that surprising that people representing registrants in the user community actually don't find some solace in the fact that they might be able to more economically defend their own intellectual property. This is about a couple of things. Not only is this about the intellectual property community and what we all must do to protect rights holders, it's also about the new domain space and other overarching issues. And I guess I'm really concerned about the fact that that we really don't have a very good economic analysis of what the true impact of this is to not only registries and registrars, but to individuals and companies, and that the economic studies that exist so far for global top-level domains don't address that. You know, we saw unfettered and unregulated expansion of our economies, and we saw some pretty bad results, of which we're all suffering. And this is a marketplace that services trillions and trillions of dollars of e-commerce, and I really think that we need to do a better job, and I call on ICANN to help us there. And lastly, before I step aside, I'd really like to see in the next draft applicant guidebook these protection mechanisms implemented that you work so hard on, so that we have a chance to evaluate whether they'll actually service us in protecting consumers and protecting brands. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Paul Lee. I'm a trademark counsel with Time Inc., a magazine publisher and media company. We have roughly 120 magazines worldwide. That's about 120 brands. My problem with the whole thing, as you might expect, is not trademark owners or trademark lawyers or the IRT, which I think has done a fair job at addressing the issues. But my problem is just the sheer scale of the whole proposal and the exponential increase in our budget. To me, it's a total budget buster. And, you know, it's been noted earlier that trademark law is a consumer protection law, and we have an obligation as a trademark owner to go after infringers or anyone using a you know, anything that's going to confuse consumers. And honestly, in this era of shrinking budgets, you know, it'll never be adequate to really go after all of the variations. So my question is, has anyone done a realistic study on what it really will cost, say, per brand, or 10 brands, or 100 brands? How much will this increase our budgets over a year, 3 years, 5 years? Because, you know, while I'm sort of thankful for the job insurance for myself, because I guess I'll always be needed, I just don't think companies can really afford this type of, you know, nuisance tax, effectively, or a business tax at this time in our you know, recession.
Yeah, and I'm not on the IRT, so I'm not speaking for the IRT. We've done a study that looks at existing defensive and other registrations in the 300 TLDs that exist today. I don't know about your company, but I do know that in the vast majority of cases, there is not widespread defensive activity outside of .com and perhaps one or two other TLDs. So that study is public, and I'll be happy to send you a link to it. It shows that the overwhelming majority of current defensive activity in existing domain space is in .com. So our argument is not that a bunch of new TLDs is not going to increase the need to do some, but we would take exception with terms like exponential growth in defensive activity, because at least on the data that we have so far, that's not been the case in the other new TLDs.
So,
Rabisha,
to show the counter to that, and I think probably to bolster up my colleague's examples and his concerns. We have done analysis of our portfolio, which last I checked was about 50,000 domain names. So again, we are part of the registrant pool in the ICANN process. And of those 50,000 domain names, about 80 to 90% are all defensive. They're defensive either through sunrise periods, they're defensive either through defensive registrations generally, or the defensive because we have to hold them after we go after these squatters retroactively. So I think, and to back that kind of analysis, Fred Feldman, who just spoke, their company in conjunction with AT&T had also put out a comment about various large brand owners and their portfolios, and actually came up with the same stats, which was something to 80 to 90% of the portfolio. So you can imagine a company who has 50,000, that's a lot of defensive dead space that's costing year after year money, and it's also prohibiting internet users, the non-commercials, the people who really want to start legitimate businesses, not to be able to, because people like Paulie are afraid that if they let go of a once infringing time dot whatever, it will again become an infringement that they have to pay $5,000 to $10,000 for. So there's obviously a flaw here, and it's why we're here. It's something that needs to be fixed.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Horowitz. I'm with Baker & Hostetler in New York City. And my question to you goes to the GPML. Has the IRT considered for the GPML the issue of German companies that because of World War I and the Treaty of Versailles, which came out in 1919, cannot do business in the U.S. and Canada? The house marks are registered in most other countries, but why should such companies not be allowed in the GPML with 4 out of 5 regions?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm actually going to defer to Kurt on this, but I'm fairly certain that in the way ICANN has divided the regions, that Mexico would be – it's not?
No, Mexico okay. is not – it's in okay. Latin America. It is not right. in North America,
no,
although
I mean,
it is a party to NAFTA.
We clearly didn't, but, you know, obviously that's a comment that I – you know, you've obviously now made it a record. So, no, we did not.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tom Barrett. I'm with Encirca, an ICANN registrar. And previously, I was with a company called Thompson & Thompson, a trademark research vendor, where I was responsible for building a new search platform for them. And I'd like you guys to actually think ahead, not 1 or 2 years, but 20 years from now, and think about you know, what you can do now so that 20 years from now, you don't need to worry about cyber squatting. And the analogy I'll give you is I'm a parent, four children. They range in age from 10 to 22. And what impresses me about the public school and education they're getting today is starting from grade school, my son will come home and tell me about the perils of the beer I'm having for dinner, or you know, he'll notice someone smoking. And so from an early age, they understand that's something you shouldn't do as you become a teenager and adult. And it took many years, but they're an educated citizen following a healthy lifestyle. So it occurs to me that our goal here, and the opportunity that ICANN has, is to create a public, a consumer, that doesn't cyber squat. Now, sure, there are some people who are going to be bad actors and will do it deliberately, but I think there's also many people who just are not aware, they're naive of trademark rights. They think they can get at their own name and use it for a certain purpose, not realizing someone else may have rights to it. Or they simply want to start a fan site. So I think your opportunity here is to build a resource that allows consumers to be aware, become educated about trademark rights, so that they don't step on someone else's rights, or they think twice before they do it. And so with that thought in mind, I just want to make two comments about the IP clearinghouse, and those comments have to do with restrictions that the IRT has appeared to place. One restriction has to do with restrictions on the users and uses of the IP clearinghouse. And the second restriction has to do with who can provide the IP clearinghouse solution to ICANN. I.e., they cannot be ICANN contracted parties. So I think dropping these two restrictions would greatly improve your outcome. And let me talk about the first one. As I said, the IP clearinghouse represents a great opportunity for consumers and the public to become more aware of trademark rights. And so it should be designed in a way to encourage public access to the database. We should, as a community, we should be conducting outreach so that consumers, you know, can go directly to the IP clearinghouse. They can verify if there's any potential trademark conflict with what they're planning to register and decide if their intended use might conflict with that. So I would drop the restriction that only registrars, registries, and ICANN can have access to the data. I think you need to make it publicly available. You need to make sure that the RFP includes mechanisms for public access to the data. And in fact, there should be regular outreach by the ICANN community to be aware of that public asset. And secondly, one of the goals is a fair and open tender for solutions for the IP clearinghouse. I think that, you know, that this is in place, I think partly in concerns that perhaps ICANN won't enforce their contract if, in fact, there's a existing ICANN contracted party who, in fact, proposes a solution. But I would propose dropping that restriction as well and see what innovative solutions might be proposed, regardless of whether or not they're currently known to the ICANN community. And if it turns out they are a well-known registrar or registry, then you address that in your contract. But don't preclude innovative solutions from at this point in time.
Thank you. Actually, can I ask a follow-up question, Caroline?
Yeah, sorry.
I'm intrigued by this idea of public access, and I guess what I'm wondering, my concern would be that obviously if you allow unfettered public access, there's really nothing to prevent somebody, and I'm sure somebody would, from designing a program that will basically ping the database so that ultimately they've checked everything and then they can replicate it.
Which, by the way, could happen today with a registry who is or the USPTO database, mm-hmm. both of which are publicly available.
Right. But I guess what I'm wondering is, would you be willing, is your interest in having public access kind of high enough that at the same token you'd be willing to agree to certain restrictions on what the public could do with that data above and beyond so that you avoid the gaming that, frankly, this community's, you know, somebody's going to find a way around something. They're very ingenious in that way.
Right. And in fact, I mean, that exists today with your registry who is. There are people gaming the registry who is today, some for intellectual property interests, some for gaming, you know, speculating interests, but that happens today. But it's, you know, some level of that is tolerated in order to ensure public access.
Right, but my question is, would you be willing, do you think that would be a good trade-off, that you could have public access, but that there would be limitations on what you could do with it, and you'd essentially agree to whatever the sanction would be?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, okay. Again, we want an educated consumer. You want 20 years from now, you don't want to have to, because, you know, this is just the first round of 500 TLDs, right? It goes on forever, long after your grandparents, right? Your grandchildren will be talking about these same issues. So you have an opportunity now to put in place something so that the public is more educated. And you'll see cyber squatting go down, and you won't have to spend money filing defensive registrations.
Okay. Let's go ahead and move on. Go ahead.
Hi. Patrick Flaherty from Verizon. We filed a number of comments with in connection with the reports today, so I'm only going to touch on just a small subset. We feel that the URS is very important to trademark owners. However, there are a number of flaws that we'd like to point out, in particular the fact that currently, as proposed, it only allows for domain names to be placed in a frozen state, which we feel doesn't provide adequate protection for trademark owners. We'd also like to see domain names be available for transfer to the trademark owner. And to give you an example why, to date, based on our own day-to-day enforcement operations in which we require that all domain names be transferred back to Verizon, we hope to generate at least additional 9 million visits to our websites from repointing domain names that we've had transferred back to us. Also, in connection with the URS, we don't consider it rapid right now. We'd ask that further consideration be given in order to make it more rapid. For example, earlier on, it was talked about making amendments to the notification procedures, like allowing for notice by fax. We think that it's important for it to be rapid because substantial damage can occur as a result of people being misdiverted from a trademark owner's website, even if only for a short term, especially in connection with phishing websites. We don't believe that we can have a domain name system for the future based on old policies and old remedies from the past. So as a result of that, we would ask that all of the recommendations made by the IRT do get implemented, but with additional protections for trademark owners. We feel that this will provide better protection for trademark owners overall. We'd also point to the Mark Monitor comments and ask that a study be conducted of just how much this will cost trademark owners over time using all of these additional protections that are being offered. Right now, based on the amount of money that we're spending enforcing our brands, we expect to see that cost either double or quadruple. So we'd also ask, finally, that in connection with the overarching issues that are still yet to be addressed, that all of those do get fully addressed before ICANN decides to move forward and roll out new TLDs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, Jeff.
Sorry, can I ask just a question?
Yes, sir.
Because on the how rapid the URS is, and I know this is a subject for the next part of the discussion, but we'll talk about malicious domain names and things that registries are doing now and can do in the future to take down phishing, farming, malware, botnets, you name all that good stuff. If there was a sufficient solution to those activities, would that lessen your concern that the URS is not rapid enough?
Yes. If additional, I suppose looking at the time frame right now as it's proposed, we don't feel that it provides adequate protection should we come across issues that need to be addressed quickly.
Thanks.
Yeah, just so we know, we need to keep things moving quickly.
Barbara Solomon from the firm Frost Zelnick in the city. We're trademark attorneys. We represent Fortune 500 companies, and we represent people who are coming out with a single product. I'm also a WIPO panelist, so I've seen it on all ends. The concern I have is really from our client's point of view, and it's been raised here. The trademark owners are spending money to go after everybody who's making money on their names. They're the ones who have to enforce it on eBay and spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to get takedowns. They have to enforce it on Google with AdSense. They have to go after iOffer. They now have to go after the registries. They have to go after the registrants. They have to file the UDRPs and pay the fees. Everything I see on this list, the trademark owners have to pay for. They have to pay to go on the clearinghouse. They have to pay for the GPM. They have to pay for the uniform rapid suspension system. They're going to have to pay for post-delegation, and they have to pay for the UDRP. People are making money on the trademarks. The registries will make money on our clients' trademarks because people will want to register them. The registrants will make money on people's trademarks because they will want to get a second-level domain name in a trademark space. What is being done for fee shifting? Why are the trademark owners have to pay all the fees? Has there been any thought? If someone thinks that what they are registering as a new TLD is not going to infringe, what thought is being given to create some type of escrow or other accounts where people will pay money that is held and it's kept there? And if no one goes after them, they get the money back. But if someone goes after them and IBM or Chanel or Verizon or Hearst or anyone else has to start a proceeding and wins, they should be compensated. If I don't return my video to Blockbuster, they have my credit card and I get charged, why aren't people who are potentially going to register improperly getting charged? Why do the trademark owners have to pay?
Jeff wanted to.
I don't want to detract because you had some really good points in there, but I hear it far too often that the registries are benefiting off of the trademark infringement. And as a registry, I could tell you it costs us far more to deal with intellectual property issues than the money we actually get in.
So
I don't want to detract because I think you made some really good points, but I think it's important to clear up because I hear it from a lot of companies is that the only people that are going to benefit from new TLDs are the registries and registrars, and the only people that benefit from intellectual property owners are the registries and registrars. And I'm just going to say that that's not exactly true.
But
why
can't there be something set up so that the same way that you can't take out a library book without giving your credit card or something, so if you don't return it, you get charged? Registrants who think the domain names they take are not infringing, you put something in reserve. And if no one comes after you after 3 months, 6 months, a year, you get it back. But if someone does come after you, then that trademark owner or whoever comes after you, if they win, they should get compensated and get their lawyer's fees back. It's the fair way. If you didn't think you did anything wrong, then posting a bond or giving a credit card, PayPal or whatever, should not be a problem. And if there are people who don't want to post money or put money in escrow, you have to wonder, what are they so afraid of that they're not willing to put money behind the registration that they're about to get? And has that been discussed as a way to do some fee shifting?
Yeah, so we've discussed all of these things. I mean, you know, we did have lots of meetings and lots of months of worth of time and emails. And yes, and you got to take a step back. And a step back is that what we're trying to do is create competition in the registry space. We're trying to create the reason for introducing new TLDs. One of the prime overarching issues is to create competition. And if you want to put all these new rules and restrictions on the new TLDs, you're basically not going to create that kind of competition.
How is competition created by not having someone put up the money behind the name they're after, they're wanting, and say, you're going to have to defend this, and if you lose, if some company has to come after you and go through any of these procedures to get the name back, you are paying because you shouldn't have done it.
Jeff, and I just want to, unless someone really wants to, I think it's a very valid point, and I'm glad that you
made.
Well, no, I think what we're trying to say is that it was considered. I mean, I think when we went into things, we decided, you know, especially in terms of, you know, respondents and to the extent we would require fees, you know, how would you actually get those fees? And so, I mean, these are things that we all considered in our discussions. Obviously, we didn't necessarily come up with your proposal, but...
And just to show that we have and probably will continue, this comment's not new. It's been made from the other side. Phil Corwin, who earlier spoke, asked in Sydney and actually asked in comments, would brand owners be willing to post a bond every time they file a URS complaint or a UDRP? To which I responded, would your clients be able to post the bond as well and then pay out? So I don't think the concept is necessarily dead, and I think it's good that you're bringing it up. I think that it's valid and it should be made in written comment as well for something that I can consider as they go through, because the fee shifting is something that I think every brand owner in this room wants. And what the IRT represents was trying to do something in the middle so that it costs less for brand owners, but it was somehow palatable to everyone else you see standing up saying, you shouldn't have any rights whatsoever.
Right.
And which is technically feasible, which is a real big part.
Go ahead.
Richard wants to answer, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry, Richard.
I just wanted to add something to that. And again, I'm not on the IRT. So, yeah, I think that's kind of a blunt instrument to my mind. That means everyone that registers a domain name would have to put up an escrow in perpetuity, presumably. I mean, the name could infringe at any point. It might not infringe today. And so you'd have to have every registrant. So I think it's kind of a blunt instrument because it's penalizing the 99% of registrants who are not infringers. Because, you know, everyone, including presumably the trademark holder as well, is going to have every registration is going to have this money in escrow as well. I just think it's a solution that attacks the problem by... I can't hear, sorry.
Credit card or PayPal.
Yeah, I think I just heard a little, but you're saying have a credit card on
file. Yeah, put a credit card on file like Blockbuster does if you're not late, or PayPal. If you're not late, you don't get charged. So in this case, the analogy would be if you don't infringe, you don't get charged. But if you do, then – and I guess my question to you, Richard, would be would you think it's less a blunt instrument to do it at the allegation of infringement that the other side also posts the bond? Would you think that that's less of a draconian procedure?
I need to think it through.
Okay. Go ahead.
My name's Jennifer Clark. I'm here as a consumer and speaking on my own behalf. With these first-level TLDs, who decides who the legitimate owner of a trademark is? I mean, we've heard from Time Inc., and Time Inc. might want time and at the first level might be very willing to pay for it and have every right to it. So might the Observatory in London. Greenwich Mean Time might be the place that Time ought to be. Who and how is such a thing going to be determined? There are companies with similar names where a trademark is in Belgium and another trademark is in Canada. The Canadian company has the .com. Does that mean the Canadian company gets the .com? Company name? Or does it just come down to who can afford it? Is Time Inc. better able to afford it than the Observatory, the Royal Observatory?
I mean, well, you know, I think Kurt addressed that in your slides in terms of the different modules that are in the DAG that I probably would refer you to that show for the string contention. I assume when you're referring to the top level and making decisions, I mean, I think one of the options when you have multiple parties claiming rights to the same term is possibly an auction.
I guess my point in that is that then it'll always, in that case, it'll go to the highest bidder, and the highest bidder might not be the most, what was the word that was used? Legitimate owner. And it's a question of determination of legitimacy, I guess. And who are your constituencies? Are the big corporations always the most legitimate owners? They can presumably pay, but is that what the internet's trying to do?
Can I
just respond to that? In the context of kind of the broader new GTLD program, mm-hmm. that is a question for ICANN.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But within the context, and it really is the only context that we dealt with it, was at the GPML, and we specifically took that into account by saying if there is, in fact, an applied for string that in the initial evaluation is deemed to be identical or confusingly similar to a mark that's on the GPML. Although there would be an initial rejection, there would be this opportunity to request reconsideration. So under your example, if it was the Observatory in London that was applying for .time for purposes of administering Greenwich Mean Time, that would be the opportunity for them to say, look, this is in our application, this is what we want to do. Depending upon how that process is actually implemented, there certainly is the possibility that you could have a situation where in that context, and assuming, of course, that the Observatory was willing to agree to be bound to those representations that it had made in the reconsideration process, then you certainly could have a situation in which it would, in fact, be allocated the TLD. But if you're talking kind of big picture, you know, who has the money to pay, that's right. Not a question for us.
Let's take the smaller picture. I presume that no one's suggesting, because it would cause confusion, that both Time Inc. and the observatory would be able to have it.
No.
Even if Time Inc. said, we're going to use it for media purposes, no. and Greenwich Mean Time said, we're going to use it for global timekeeping purposes. And I think that that's the problem, that you're going to end up within the very limited realm that you're looking at, with competing legitimacies, and who is the arbitrator?
You're absolutely right. And when it comes right down to it, you can only have one TLD for a particular string. You can't, as I understand it, is a room of people who would know to the contrary. You can't have different people using the same string.
It would be confusion, and you're trying to avoid confusion.
It just technically isn't even possible. Setting aside confusion.
No, and that's the problem of the space. If we stick to the schedule, I have at least 7 minutes. So I'm going to ask that, I think there's a couple people I know who asked questions before. I might ask that, if we have time, fine. But if not, because I know you're standing there, I don't want you to stand there and be disappointed. But if we can kind of keep our comments to a couple minutes, just so we can at least hit the people that are new here, that'd be great.
I'll try and speak quickly. Thank you. My name is Anthony Vancouver. I'm the CEO of Minds and Machines, and I'm here on behalf of my company and also on behalf of some of the clients that we're working with on new GTLDs. And prior to this, I ran a company called Name Engine, which worked with many Fortune 500 companies dealing with their marks and domain names around the world. And one of our partners, our sister company, in fact, is COCA, which is a cooperative registry system which works with over 20 countries around the world. So from that perspective, I'd like to make a couple of comments. First, it might be useful to remind people who are worried about this process that not everything is a clone of .com, so that you're going to have very specific registries with very specific policies. The example of .shu was used before. Now, I know from my previous experience that very few trademark holders are registering names in Zimbabwe, for instance. They don't do any business there. In fact, business is impossible there. It's just not a good place to have a domain name, and typically when piracies occur in those places, they're not nearly as interested in those as they are in .com. So realize that there is not a black and white here. There's a continuum of interest both on the part of cyber squatters and of trademark holders. So I'd like to speak to the IRT recommendations and what I think
about. Pick your big, your most important nugget there.
Yeah. Basically, I'd like to thank the IRT. I think they did a great job, and broadly we're in support of just about all the recommendations. We think that it's great to break the logjam. I'm very happy to see trademark owners step up to the plate and play a positive role and begin to grapple with the issues, realizing that the Internet does move forward. So very much in favor of the electronic clearinghouse, which I believe will allow smaller registries to implement policies that are tailored to the area that they're working in. So .shoes can certainly prevent trademark infringements on Nike, which makes shoes, but sorry, Apple computer, you don't make shoes, no protection for you. And that seems to me to mirror the real world in a much better way. The thick who is, a great idea. I never even understood why there was a thin who is. And the rapid takedown system, we know from working with CCTLDs and COCA that some swift action early on, people go back to .com where it's easy. We're looking forward to a series of policies that allow registries to actually police their own space. And we don't think that it should be incumbent on trademark owners only. We think when we have registries that care about their space, instead of punting to ICANN, they will take enforcement measures on their own. And so a lot of these policies are simply tools for those.
You can wrap up.
Don't like the GPML. WIPO produces a list I'm happy to look at, and the post-delegation policy is ICANN's problem, and they're the police. They should police their own contracts. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Go ahead.
I am Mark Trachtenberg with Winston & Strawn. I'm an IP attorney in Chicago. We represent a lot of large brand owners, but also search engines and parking companies, so a lot of players who are impacted by this. And my question is actually for Richard specifically. You said that you supported the URS, but that you also supported having a minimum number of domain names registered by a particular registrant in order to qualify for using the URS. And I guess I would just like to, you know, really understand your reasoning behind that. Obviously, you know, you said it was to avoid abuse of the system, but it seems to me that you really take the teeth out of the URS by doing that, because essentially you allow bad actors to know how to game the system and avoid enforcement by registering N-1 domain names. Mm-hmm. And under your scenario, for example, if you have, let's say it's 10, if you have one registrant which has, you know, 10 squatted domain names with PPC on them, and maybe there's not a lot of traffic, but then you have another registrant that has one squatted domain name where there's ongoing active fraud, which is really affecting a lot of people immediately and costing consumers a lot of money, or maybe compromising their private information, the person who owns the brand or who's being defrauded could not take action against that single registrant because they only have one domain name. And beyond that, you know, how would you even define registrant for the purposes of, you know, using that as a rule for the URS? Because in light of, you know, proxy registration and the gigantic abundance of false WHOIS information, I just don't see how that's a practical solution.
Richard?
Yeah, so I think, you know, they're fair comments. It was one potential solution to what we see, you know, is going to be abuse. So, you know, the concept that you're going to be able to aggregate registrants is already in the report, right? It already talks about the idea. That's, you can file up to one claim on up to, what's the maximum, 300? No, I guess there is no maximum. So, yeah, I mean, so that problem's already there. If people can avoid the solution that I proposed, if you like, by what you said, which I see where you're going with that, then they're also going to be able to avoid the current mechanism, and that in that case, you know, most claims are going to be $200 each. So I think that problem of evasion of finding who the registrant is already somewhat there.
But yeah. I mean, that shouldn't relate to the URS, though, because, you know, really for the cases where you need to take action immediately, I mean, the URS, the way I understand it, is a mechanism to allow, you know, brand owners and other people with interest to take action immediately when it's a really obvious situation. So why should it matter how many domain names?
Yeah, and I hear you, and again, I think that's a fair comment. I mean, we approach that potential solution from the perspective of what's the, you know, because you've got the UDRP. The UDRP is the solution now. You know, where was the URS coming from? Our sense was, as a commentator, our sense was it was coming from trying to get at bad actors who really have a lot of domain names, to do sort of serial infringement, if you like. So, you know, our worry is the small player who gets caught in that net, and typically small players don't have lots of domain names. So we thought we could maybe, with that solution, protect those, you know, the individual domain holders. I recognize that some people may still infringe with one domain. I'm not saying that's not the case. In that case, you'd go after them with the UDRP. So, I think, you know, we think it's worth some debate on that point. If the URS is going after serial cyber squatters, then maybe that's a way, by putting a minimum limit, maybe that's a way to reduce the side effects.
Yeah, let me just do a follow-up, Mark.
But why is it only for serial cyber squatters? I don't understand that. I mean,
yeah, no, and that's a fair point. Let me just do a follow-up. I think Richard was referring to the provision in the recommendation where if a specific registrant has 26 or more domain names under the complaint, you know, in the complaint, then there's an answer fee required. It was something. It was very important to us, and a lot of discussion we had about should there be an answer fee? Should it be loser pay? Should it just be? Should someone have to pay to defend their domain name? And we came out on the side that if it's fewer than 25 or 25 and fewer, then you wouldn't have to pay to defend. But if it's 26 or more, you would. So that aggregation point that you made is already in the proposed.
But he's talking about having a minimum of.
No, I understand what it's a separate point. But his right. response to you was the concept of aggregating domain names and looking at a number is already in there.
Okay, can we go to the next slide? And Kurt, could we? It's 1:32. I have. Do we have 5 minutes?
Or? 2:32.
I'm sorry, 2:32. Okay.
Great. My name is Sasha Tarrant. I'm the Senior Manager of Digital Rights Enforcement and Research with the National Basketball Association. I make this statement not only on behalf of the NBA, but also on behalf of the Collegiate Licensing Company, Major League Baseball, the National Football League, and the National Hockey League. The four professional sports leagues each consist of dozens of teams or clubs, and CLC represents nearly 200 collegiate institutions. Each of these teams and educational institutions represents a unique brand, and each owns a variety of associated trademarks. CLC and the League devotes millions of dollars a year towards protecting these valuable intellectual property assets and enforcing against their unauthorized use, including with respect to infringing domain names registered in the current GTLDs. These enforcement efforts are undertaken to protect our millions of fans from potential consumer confusion and instill consumer confidence in the brands we represent, which is damaged by domain names that infringe against those brands. The scale of abuse likely to result due to the availability of hundreds of new GTLDs and the corresponding trademark infringement would impose significant additional burdens on the ability of trademark owners to protect their intellectual property and prevent the consumer confusion that would ultimately arise, particularly since CLC and the leagues each are responsible for enforcing the intellectual property rights of multiple brands. We are concerned about the feasibility of effective enforcement in this context. Given the number of trademarks each of us is responsible for policing, it is not feasible, especially in today's economic environment, to expend the resources necessary to pursue the infringing use of every one of our brands and domain names registered in such an expanded offering of the GTLDs. For these reasons, we do not support the proposed rollout of unlimited GTLDs. If, however, the new GTLDs are made available on this scale, we believe it'd be critical to adopt comprehensive solutions and develop effective tools aimed at preventing the infringement of our trademarks and allowing us to effectively enforce against those who violate our intellectual property rights. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is John Berryhill. I'm an intellectual property attorney from Philadelphia. I primarily represent domain name registrants in domain name dispute proceedings. I've defended such cyber squatters as a gentleman who had decal.com and was selling decals, a gentleman who had snowboardsforsale.com and who was selling snowboards, a gentleman who had elephant.com for a website about elephants. All of these were the subject of overreaching trademark claims and dispute proceedings. I think the IRT has done a really good job and in producing a number of very good proposals in a very short amount of time, and I'm impressed at the thoughtfulness that went into many of it, and I believe that going forward, the IRT will likely continue to exercise that thoughtfulness. It's hard to criticize, you know, specific things. I mean, I can nibble around the edges like Mr. Tyndall on the URS. I think the URS is on the right track. I don't think it's there yet, and I think that the IRT suffers from, not, you know, trademark abuse, trademark misuse is something of an abstract to many of the people who primarily do trademark enforcement. And as you proceed to drafting, I hope that, you know, you take input. Let me give you one example. In the URS, you have this requirement that a printout of the web page be filed at the time of the complaint. Okay. Last night, just before midnight, I filed a UDRP response in a case where a South Florida ISP has been using a domain name since 1996. Since 2002, they've had a later trademark owner from Germany in different goods and services pestering them about this domain name. Earlier this year, they had a server malfunction for a couple of weeks, and that's the point in time when this German company with the trademark took the snapshot of the website, filed the UDRP complaint, denied knowledge, or just ignored the fact that the domain name has been used for 13 years, and then it rolls. The built-in assumption that any particular snapshot chosen by a complainant is going to be representative of what the use of the domain name be, you know, may not be the best assumption. The other thing that I really appreciate in the IRT report is the general principle that these policies are administrative policies. They are not intended to give trademark owners greater rights than they have in the real world. Now, today, a few minutes ago, you heard a sideways mention of a case that was decided by the Southern District Court of New York on this island in 1988. That case was Hearst v. Goldberger. It involved a claim against a New Jersey attorney who uses a variant of the term Esquire because he is an attorney. Hearst's complaint in that case was dismissed, and you lost, Mr. Neuger. This is not the forum for a second bite at the apple. Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
No, yeah, I'm going to say, yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Real quick.
John, so if a snapshot of a website at that moment is not, what could be supplied as evidence, or what's like an alternative?
I just think over-reliance on it. I mean, you know, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And things like archive.org are good, where a domain name has been in use a long time. Archive doesn't provide recent snapshots. But, you know, if someone hacks your website and puts porn on it, and then somebody else comes along and complains about it, the other things that we've seen in some of the generic domain name cases, like pig.com, is that if there are Google ads or automated paid advertising on a page, for a generic word, a arbitrary mark owner, all right, will actually buy Google ads for things that are not related to their mark so that they can cause their ads to appear on those pages, and then they take the damning snapshot of an infringement. So, you know, over-reliance on one particular snapshot, maybe a couple of snapshots over a period of time, but allowing an opportunity to rebut that evidence.
So John, these are all clear cases under the URS that it's not a slam dunk. You know, you file your answer and say this is not the website that's been up there forever, and it's bounced.
And the UDRP itself was sold as being for clear-cut cases of bad faith cyber-squatting. You know, I mean, things tend to
Point taken.
Thanks. We're going to go with Robin, and then we're going to finish these three who have not spoken yet, and then we're going to have to call it quits, and maybe we'll take some from the chat room.
Hi, I'm Robin Max from Chanel. Somebody addressed this earlier, but I don't think I really understood the answer. There are quite a number of multinational corporations who have their trademarks owned by different entities, sister companies across the world. And I'm a little bit confused that the GPML, how that's going to work if you have, let's say, 25 companies that own two registrations, you know, for two different countries. You might not make it onto that list, because even though you're, I'll use the word, very famous trademark.
Right. Christina, you want to do that?
You would be stunned if you knew how much time we spent talking about that very issue, actually. The long and the short of it is that we envision that there would, in fact, be a mechanism that where, in fact, you do have a mark that has different owners within the same corporate family is kind of one direction. We're kind of divided. Do we keep it within the corporate family? Do we allow licensees? Because once you allow licensees, you run into fraud. But our idea was that there should be a mechanism whereby, at least within ownership among the same corporate family, that you could have one entity kind of applying for the GPML status and then referring to all of the other marks owned by related entities, and you'd have to have supporting documentation. But the idea was, you know, we are, in fact, acutely aware of some of the holding company structures that are put into place for tax purposes, and there was really no intention to deprive those entities of the opportunity.
Just so long as one entity will be allowed to apply on behalf of. Okay. Thank you.
My name is Donna Tobin. I'm a partner in the law firm of Baker & Hostetler here in New York. The IRT suggests that closed GLTD registries could be exempt from rights protection mechanisms for second-level domain names. So a registry for a closed GTLD could permit the use of a second-level domain that incorporates another's trademark. For example, .Panasonic could allow the registration of Sony.Panasonic. And if we had time, I'd love to know the IRT's thinking on this.
Mm-hmm. Jeff?
So what you're saying was not intended, and I don't think the words actually say that. I think what the words say, or what our intent was, is that a closed TLD could have rights protection mechanisms that are a lot stronger than the rights protection mechanisms that the IRT is recommending, and therefore wouldn't necessarily need what the IRT is recommending. For example, if there is a closed TLD like a .Panasonic, and Panasonic runs that, and Panasonic wants to close that to only its own employees, there's no need to employ a GPML list for .Panasonic. There's no need for Panasonic to implement an IP claims process. There's no need for Panasonic to do a thick whois, maybe. Okay, so there are certain protections that may not be necessary for a .brand TLD or a closed TLD. It's not that we were saying that if you're closed, you could just throw everything out the window. It's that we're saying that if you could show to ICANN in your application that you're providing rights mechanisms above and beyond what the limited amounts the IRT is recommending, then you don't necessarily have to do some of the things that the IRT is recommending.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Rick McMurtry. I'm an assistant general counsel with Turner Broadcasting and a sub of Time Warner. I will go on record that obviously we do not favor new GTLDs. We don't see an economic need for it, and it's going to be an overbearing cost to brand owners. In addition, I appreciate the woman's comments from Frost Zelnick that fee shifting may be a reasonable way to sort of offset those overwhelming costs. And it is something that we put in our paper, in the Time Warner paper, so I won't reiterate it here other than just to say that obviously we disfavor it and we think there need to be more protections. And in fact, the IRT recommendations don't go far enough because they don't protect, they don't prevent, I should say, the most rampant form of cyber squatting, which is typo squatting or use of your mark with a generic term that's relevant to your business, like CNN News. Even the GPML wouldn't protect us from that. That said, I think everybody can agree in this room that we don't want our children seeing porn when they're looking for Scooby-Doo. We don't want people being misled that there's anthrax at their workplace after 9/11, believing it to be a legitimate CNN news story. And we don't want people buying substandard VHS tapes or not receiving them at all because they were swindled because they thought it was a Turner Classic Movies website. All of those things have happened to our company and do happen to our company on a regular basis, and we have to protect our consumers against it. And we can also all agree, I think, that we want to give individuals the opportunity to comment. Lord knows, you know, CNN is a champion of free speech. If you want to talk about CNN, we are more than happy for you to do that in any aspect that you want whatsoever. And so there must be a mechanism that would allow for the individual registrant to do so. And I do think that that fee-shifting model would be a feasible way to do that. That's what I'm saying on the record. I have one question, and that's for Richard. You said that you thought the URS was opened itself up to a lot of abuse by trademark owners. But what is the basis for claiming that? We had your co-speaker, Brian, said that over 75% of the cases, there's no response at all. And I believe last time I looked, and it's been a while, so I could be wrong on the numbers, that over 95% of complainants in the UDRP win that action. And in most cases, brand owners don't go after it unless it's pretty much a slam dunk because it's not worth the money, the time, or the administrative expense to do that. So what makes you think that brand owners are going to abuse the URS system? And if you do think they will, then isn't there another way, like a penalty against the brand owner or something, rather than just putting in these really blunt instruments, to use your term, to protect against it?
Yeah, so... Yeah, I mean, we think that the majority of the URS cases will be successful and appropriate decisions, but we think there's going to be tens of thousands of URS cases, quite possibly hundreds of thousands, if we're talking about expanding.
On what basis, though, other than just pure speculation? I mean, the numbers support the fact that brand owners don't abuse.
Well, okay, so how many UDRP cases are there sort of in any given year at the moment?
Let me grab that one if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Okay. So essentially, we knew that if we created a faster, cheaper system, that it would be more prone for abuse. We took that into consideration. We talked about that a lot. I listed 8 or 7 different ways that we're working, and our recommendations would be working to prevent that abuse. And there is a proposal in there that if 3 strikes and you're out proposal, that if you do abuse it. There are fringe cases on both sides, and I think we'll all agree to that, and, you know, John pointed to a couple. So we knew that there would be likely some abuse of the system, and we put in some protections that we recommended to address those abuses.
But I don't think any model should be based on the fringe cases. I think it should be based on the 95% of cases that are legitimate.
Okay.
Yeah, and
Thank you.
I agree with that. I think the challenge is to find some protections to try and minimize. I mean, if there are 100,000 URS cases and 5% of them are abusive in some way, what we're saying is let's find a way to minimize that. And the notion of a bond or something of that nature, we think is an idea worth looking at for sure.
Sure. Mark?
Thanks. My name is Mark Bohannon. Been an active member of the ICANN community since its inception in both a volunteer and sometimes a not-so-volunteer role. I'm currently the general counsel and senior vice president for the Principal Association of Software and Information Content Companies, SWIA. We submitted comments. I just want to reaffirm we support the thrust of the IRT report with one major caveat, that it be a baseline for what are the protections. We are in a situation where we're not just talking about the rollout of maybe one TLD 10 TLDs, even doubling the number of TLDs. The numbers of projections are even close. We're talking about hundreds, which is way beyond anything ICANN has ever undertaken since its inception. The protections here are about making sure there is confidence building, stability, adequate competition, and meaningful security. And this is the only effort so far that has gone into and drilled down on the detail necessary to get all of those essential issues correct. With that in mind, I appreciate the presentations by Enom and WIPO today. In our view, again, we can only react to what we've seen so far today because I haven't seen anything else published. I don't think they meet the baseline. So if new gTLDs are going to go forward, there's got to be at least the level of confidence-building measures found in the IRT report. Otherwise, we're going to have utter chaos, economic damage, and a lot of frustrated users and consumers.
Carla.
Hi, I'm Carla Valenti with ICANN, and I'm here to convey to the panel the questions that we have in the chat room. As you know, we have a live broadcast of this event with about 44 remote participants. We have five questions, so one of them is ICANN paying for some members of the IRT to attend these consultations?
Yes.
Is what?
Is ICANN paying for some of the IRT members to attend these consultations?
ICANN's reimbursing some travel expenses.
And the second one is, trademark owners are legally required to protect their marks. If they want additional protections, like the IP clearinghouse, why shouldn't they pay for it? Why should other stakeholders share in the cost of protecting other marks? And another comment was, why should registrars have to foot the bill?
Well, right now, as the IRT report is written, and this is just from the IRT report, which is what we can answer to, it actually is written that the brand owners pay. And as you've seen, I think brand owners aren't happy with that resolution, but it has actually meant that brand owners have to pay into the clearinghouse, which would get them on things like the GPML, and brand owners have to pay again to basically recertify that their brands are in continuing registration form. So we weren't the ones who said that brand owners shouldn't have to pay, at least not our proposal.
Thank you. Anything else?
Okay. Can I actually just add a clarification just to Kurt's answer for that person? I know that ICANN is paying for the reimbursement of travel expenses for some of the participants, but to my knowledge, is not paying for the time for any of them. And at least speaking personally, I'm not only not getting reimbursed for travel expenses, but the travel expenses are frankly a small fraction of what the total would be for the time. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
And I think that's an excellent point to close on the volunteerism and the effort that's gone on here. I want to compliment nearly everyone in the audience for a really constructive session. For those that are, all of you are very interested in the use to which your comments will be put, there is an MP3 of the session that will be posted and eventually transcribed for use in creating a synthesis of what went on here, so that's great. Congratulations, too, on running over time, which means we have another very interesting session about malicious conduct in the DNS that's supposed to start a few minutes ago. So if we could take, really take 5 to 10 minutes and be seated again, we're going to reconvene a different panel in another interesting session. But thank you very much to everybody seated here for going through today's work.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Greg Rattray. I'm on the ICANN staff as the Chief Internet Security Advisor and basically the staff lead for the issue on one of the overarching issues, the issue on malicious conduct, and also the panel moderator for this afternoon's panel on that topic. And if we could get the slides queued up. We have a set of presentations this afternoon. Where we're at time-wise, it's a little after 3. This panel is supposed to conclude at 4. We'll probably go a little bit over in talking with Kurt. Probably go to 4:10, 4:15, and then there'll be some time there for discussing the overarching issues on root scaling and the economic dimensions. I'd asked each of the panelists, they each have a set of remarks to keep to about 10 minutes or so to give us some time for discussion at the end. I am going to kick off with a short presentation that kind of talks to, you know, what the consultative process has looked like so far on the issue of malicious conduct. We haven't formed an IRT-like group to kind of, you know, lead the formation of alternatives in this area, and I will talk a little bit about who has been engaged, and then the key stakeholders in three of those four efforts are up here this afternoon, and they'll discuss their perspectives individually. Let's see how this goes. So I just wanted to address these key issues. I thought it was useful, and I did this in Sydney as well, to make sure that we talk about malicious conduct, and given that this comes right on the heels of the trademark protection discussion, to talk a little bit about how we're distinguishing those issues and then acknowledge the fact that the